Gator, A Story in the World of Fate's Worse than Death by Brian St. Clair King. Andrew Tim swam through the cold, dark water. Andrew breathed in the warm oxygen, created electrochemically from a small pellet of material in a metal canister on his back, through the rubber mouthpiece. Under the water, it was quiet. Although his night vision goggles were on full gain, and thus crackling with white static, nothing appeared beneath him but darkness. Then, broken pavement appeared below him, illuminated by the moon above, and slid under and past him. Looking up, he could see the bottom half of an open doorway. As he swam in, he felt the constant pull of current that had been tugging at him disappear. Andrew planted his feet and stood up. The water was up to his navel. He could feel hard floor under a layer of mud through the thin rubber soles of his shoes. He was in a large lobby area. The windows were open holes, the glass long since smashed, that let the moonlight and light pollution in. With his goggles amplifying the light, he could see the brick walls far into the distance on either side. At the far end of the lobby, a grand staircase was partially collapsed. The ceiling above him was full of holes, and through them he could see into the second level and, through the missing roof, the dull light of the sky as seen through his goggles. The entire room was filled with black water, like a giant swimming pool. Cold water dripped down Andrew into the water. Inside his black wetsuit, he could feel the strips of electronic heating elements, like a warm lover's arms wrapped around his torso. He opened his jaw and spat out the rubber mouthpiece. He removed the part of the face mask that covered his mouth, pulling it down and leaving it below his chin. He whispered, "Mode, night vision, and infrared." The goggles pressed up against his eyes blinked. Now, in addition to the artificially bright view of the building's interior, he could see a pulsing red dot in the distance. The infrared couldn't see a body through the cold water, but it could register a head poking above the water to breathe. "I know you're here," Andrew said loudly. The red dot blinked out, evidence that the person had gone completely under. Even with the light amplification, the darkness and the reflectivity of the water conspired to make it look like a sheet of blackness with little white sparkles dancing upon it. Although he knew someone was moving in the water, he couldn't perceive any movement. Andrew put his hand to his face mask, ready to put it on in a second should he be pulled under. Then the red light blinked on again, having closed about half the distance to him and moved to the other side of the room. It stayed still and quiet. "I still know you're there," Andrew said in a bored voice. "That's some fancy gear you've got," came the gravelly voice of Peter Tim. "The Tims are moving up in the world," Andrew replied. "Really? Because last time I checked, we're still a bunch of poor homeless people trying to keep our bellies from being empty. You're the only one I see with that fancy-ass shit." "It's not like that, Peter," Andrew said. "We can't buy fancy stuff for everyone, but we can buy it for one person, and that one person can use it to help all the rest of the family." There was no answer. "Do you know why I'm here, Peter?" Andrew asked.
"I think I have an idea."
"I'm here because of the people you killed."
"They were trespassing on water rat turf."
"Jesus Christ, Peter. They weren't gang members. They weren't even from the city. They were a couple of rich corporate fat asses trying to relive their glory days as teenage urban explorers. They didn't know it was our turf."
"For years," Peter said, "you people have been bringing fuckers here when you want them killed. Some asshole is chasing you in a speedboat and you run here so that I can kill them. And now you guys are going to start complaining that I killed someone?"
Andrew Tim pulled a small Ziploc baggie out of a pocket on his wetsuit. Inside were a few cigarettes and a disposable lighter. He carefully opened the baggie and lit a cigarette. All the while he kept a careful eye on the red dot that was his brother's head poking out of the cold, black water. Peter Tim had been the first of the Tim siblings, founders of the Water Rats, to ever kill anybody. This was about a year after Peter's accident. The Tims had been caught shoplifting, and the muscular, shaven-headed security guard just wouldn't stop chasing them. The Tims had run to the chain-link fence that separated this regular city from the Sunken City, those parts of Manhattan lost to rising ocean levels, and had scrambled through holes in the fence, but the security guard had scrambled through after them. They had waded deep into the swiftly moving water between the ruined buildings, but the security guard had waded after. "Back off!" the siblings had shouted, but the security guard had a look of rage on his face. Peter had gone under, and even though the guy had seen Peter swimming right at him and had tried to kick, Peter grabbed the man's legs and pulled him under. The man was about a foot and a half taller than Peter, probably weighed 100 more pounds, most of that muscle, but Peter had held the man's head and himself underwater. The security guard grabbed Peter's arms, and just when he was about to force them apart, Peter started turning. He turned over and over in the water, and the security guard went with him. The other siblings could see first Peter's body, then the guards, then Peter's, then the guards, over and over as they turned. That's when the guards started to panic. The siblings knew, because they had all wrestled with Peter in the water for fun, that the guard had lost any sense of which way was up. He didn't know which way to try to fight to get to for air. Instead of being smart and prying Peter's hands loose, or hurting Peter until Peter broke it off, the guard started to thrash wildly. He kicked his arms and legs, using up his oxygen much more quickly than he would have otherwise. After a few minutes, the guard's thrashing grew weaker. Peter slowed and stopped the spinning. He came up for a quick breath, and then immediately went back down. He held the security guard down until he stopped moving entirely, which took several minutes, and then held him down several more minutes, just to be sure. Then the Timps stole anything of value from the man's pockets and pushed him out to float away down the East River. Peter had refined his technique over the years. Eventually, some new member of their growing extended family had read that this spinning, disorienting attack was how alligators and crocodiles killed their victims, and Peter gained the nickname Gator. Orange lights danced in Andrew's view as the infrared goggles picked up the hot smoke from his cigarette. "You've gotten this family in a lot of trouble, Peter. Maybe you've been here by yourself too long. Maybe you don't know how things work now. The corpse lost two of their own, which means they put pressure on the mayor's office, and the mayor puts pressure on the cops, and the cops make it very difficult for us."
"Since when do water rats care what cops think?" Peter asked.
"There's the kind of mad that happens when we're ripping off convenience stores, and then there's the kind of mad that happens when people with political fucking power start heaping shit on the city. We're safe on Roosevelt Island not because we're invulnerable, but because it's hard enough to attack us there that nobody who matters has gotten angry enough to launch a full-on assault. Do you really want that to change?"
"So what do you want me to do? Apologize? Promise to never do it again?"
"Someone's got to go down for this. The night shift are demanding that we give them the person who did it."
"You're fucking kidding me."
"I wish I was. It's for the good of the family, Peter. You killed some people you shouldn't have, and now you're going to have to pay the price."
Peter dove. Andrew kept his gaze solidly on the water in front of him, a sheet of black dancing with bits of white, as his right hand put the mask over his mouth and he bit down on the rubber mouthpiece. Andrew saw the shape of Peter flitting through the water just moments before he emerged. Peter rose from the water so quickly that water splashed Andrew. Peter was now standing only a few feet from Andrew.
"No," Peter growled.
Andrew pulled the bottom part of his mask off so that the mouthpiece was out of his mouth, but held on to it.
"They didn't send me here to ask you nicely," he replied.
"That's a good question, Andy. Why did they send you here, all by yourself?"
"They sent me because I'm the one in the family who takes care of things." Peter stepped a single step closer to his brother. At this distance, Andrew couldn't help but be reminded that his brother was a few inches taller than he. Andrew could clearly see the pink scars interrupting Peter's light brown skin. He could see his brother wore a black wetsuit made from pieces of refuse cloth and rubber, stitched together clumsily with fishing line. From a belt hung a long, curved knife in a sheath.
"You remember the day I got burned?" Peter asked.
"Of course I remember," Andrew said, attempting to insert some tenderness into his voice. One hot summer day, when the Tim siblings were still just kids, they'd been swimming in the East River for fun. It was just them, as nobody else in the city was brave enough or a strong enough swimmer to swim against the East River currents. Some factory or ship upstream had dumped some caustic chemical into the river. It floated on the top of the river, giving off the rainbow reflections of a soap bubble in the sun. Andrew, who had been on the pier, noticed it first and yelled to his brothers and sisters. Most had either heard Andrew or had noticed it themselves and had swum back to the pier. It was only Peter, who had been too busy diving as deep and as long as he could, who didn't get out of the water in time. The siblings rushed Peter to the hospital, but they had been unable to do anything. Peter suffered disfiguring chemical burns all over his body. Luckily, he had been wearing swim goggles, so he was not blinded. Peter recovered, physically, although he still complained of pain. What really changed was his personality. Slowly, over the course of years, he became more and more socially withdrawn. He would talk less, he would stay off to the side during group meals, and eventually he would stop hanging out with his siblings altogether. Maybe he couldn't stand the pained, guilty looks that his siblings and their ever-growing extended family got when they looked at his scarred face. Peter moved away from the semi-submerged ruins of Roosevelt Island, where the rest of the family were squatting, and moved into a smaller ruin, a lone hulk of a building poking out of the water in the middle of upper New York Bay. When asked why, he only said that he wanted to be left alone. Other family members brought him food and supplies. In exchange, everyone knew that Peter's ruin was a place they could go to have a surprise attack launched against whoever they brought with them or whoever chased after them.
"This isn't about that, Peter," Andrew said sincerely. "We've always considered you a part of the family, just as much as everyone else, even when you didn't feel like you were."
That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, where were you when that poison came floating down the river?
Andrew could remember the rotten old wooden pier. Once, before they were born, it had stood high above the water. Now, however, the water rose above it during high tides, and on that day the water lapped at its sides. He could remember that the waterlogged wood felt soft, and sometimes he would reach down and pull off soft pieces. Behind him lay the sunken city. Before him lay the East River. He could see the ruins of Roosevelt Island poking out of the sea, and the ruins of the Queensboro Bridge stretching across it. Across the water, on the far shore, he could see the sunken city of Brooklyn. Beyond that, and beyond tall barbed wire fences, the buildings were clean and in good repair, owned by gated communities and corporations. By some accident of history that the young Timms didn't at the time understand, the buildings on the opposite side of the river had new paint and unbroken windows, while the buildings on their side of the river still showed scars of war. The sun was shining bright on the water. Andrew had dipped himself in the water to cool off and wash off the sweat. His siblings were in the water, swimming hard against the strong currents. He was watching them when he saw the multicolored reflections of the water that spoke of something floating at the top. Soon after, he smelled something chemical and nasty, and his eyes started to burn. "I was there," Andrew said. "I'm the one who tried to warn you."
"Were you in the water?"
"No."
"Why not?"
Andrew shrugged. "I don't remember. I didn't feel like swimming." Peter took another step forward, now in arm's reach.
"Because there was nothing in it for you. We were in the water because it was fun. It was challenging. It was dangerous. We were there because we were doing something nobody else in the city could dare to do. But you," he poked Andrew's chest with his scarred forefinger, "you don't do anything unless there's something in it for you."
"I look out for this family."
"Do you really think it's a secret where you get all that money? If I know, then everyone knows."
"Every penny I get goes to help the family. You don't like that I have a fancy rebreather and fancy goggles? I bought those so I can do things for the family."
"Yeah, things like smuggle drugs for the drug lords." Peter spat, his voice rising in pitch and volume. "The drug lords! The people we swore when we were kids that we would never be like, and you're doing business with them."
"We're not homeless kids anymore. We're a powerful street family. When we were kids, we thought that because we didn't have papers, we'd be poor and helpless forever. Now we support a dozen households, and people are scared to mess with us. We're on our way up, Peter, and we're never going to be drug dealers. We just do jobs for people that can pay, and that includes the drug lords."
"Did you ask Matt before you started swinging drugs into the city for the drug lords?"
"Matt knows, and Matt hasn't told me to stop."
"So in other words, no, you didn't ask him."
This time Andrew took a step closer. Now they were close enough to feel each other's breath. "I do what I need to in order to help the family."
"I'll tell you why they sent you here. All by your lonesome to try to bring me in," Peter growled. "It's because the water rats only need one monster. They only need one person who's part of the family but not part of the family, who can do things that nobody else has the heart to do. And it's either going to be you or it's going to be me. And I'll tell you something, Andy. It's not going to be you."
Andrew took in a breath to make a reply, but Peter launched himself forward, leaping almost all the way out of the water to tackle Andrew. Together they fell into the cold, black water. Peter's arms were clenched tight around Andrew. As soon as the water closed in over them, Peter started gyrating his entire body, such that it started both of them turning over and over. Andrew sucked air from his rubber mouthpiece. He forced his mind to go to the plan he'd rehearsed. His hand snaked to his side, past the hard muscles of his brother's arms to his belt. He pulled the long, thin, laser-sharpened knife from its scabbard. Just then, Andrew's head was rammed savagely into a brick wall. The pain and shock made Andrew reel, and he lost his grip on the knife. Then he felt a hand grab the lower part of his face mask and rip it off. The rubber straps that held onto it dug into the back of his neck and then snapped. And the world was spinning, and Andrew couldn't tell which way was up, where his next breath of air might come from. His plan and his resolve disappeared, and in its place, pure, blind fear.